Welcome to the Founders Odyssey podcast. The journey of a founder is unlike any other. The chips are seemingly stacked against you as an entrepreneur, but the burning desire to revolutionize the world and leave a lasting impact is stronger now than ever with many founders. Our podcast looks to inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs to pursue their next great idea, educate them on how to make this impossibility a reality, and create a supportive group of entrepreneurs who are there for their fellow founders. Our podcast features only the highest performing entrepreneurs who have bootstrapped, raised funds, built companies, sold companies, and have experienced life-altering challenges and some significant triumphs. Join us on this journey with the Founders Odyssey podcast and listen in on this upcoming episode.
Welcome to the Founders Odyssey podcast, where we create an environment for founders to thrive through education, inspiration, and a supportive community. My name is Nathan Bird, and I'll be your host today. Today, we are joined with innovative partners and successful entrepreneur Sean Kimball, the Chief Operating Officer, and Uber Javed, CEO of Nomix, where they are embracing the future of finance through tokenization and are harnessing the transformative power of blockchain-based assets and helping you take advantage of fractional ownership, automation, and unlocking a world of financial possibilities. Join us on this episode to learn more about the journey of developing this company, the problems they've seen in the market, and how their solution is the next big thing. So guys, I'm excited to have you here. Obviously, we have two founders, two different backgrounds, people that have extensive knowledge in what they do. So share with us, Sean, just a little bit about yourself, how you got in the entrepreneur game, and then we'll kick it over to Uber here.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm a little bit opposite of Uber. I'm from Salt Lake. I was born here and moved to San Diego right after I was born, and then found my way back here in 2002. And that's when I started going to Utah Valley State College at the time, now UVU. Lasted for about a semester, figured out real quickly that I was destined for something else other than college education at the time. And from there, I started dabbling in, at the time, was just iPod accessories. It was actually four button and click wheel iPod accessories at the time. And I was importing silicone skins from China. And then selling them here at Fashion Place Mall, Southtown, then on to Vegas and San Diego. It was interesting because it was a great idea. It was ahead of its time. There actually wasn't an accessory line at the time that was being developed, and I probably should have stuck with it, but I didn't like working retail. So I sold it to another kiosk owner and got out of it, and I look back on it now, and I kind of kick myself. Actually, an interesting moment of that time was Invisible Shield came to me and said, hey, we would like you to start selling this product in your store. And they came to me with a manila envelope. And in this manila envelope was clear bra, die cut. And they just handed it to me. And they say, I was literally the first person to ever have Invisible Shield in my possession. And I had the opportunity to take off with it.
Yes.
And, I sold my store. Didn't really have a lot of interest. Now it's Zag. Right. And that's another, thing you look back on. And you're just like, man, I kind of let that one go to the wayside. And now I actually live across the street from the Zag corporate office. So every time I leave my house, I have to
constant reminder
run into this building and remind myself of that missed opportunity. But those missed opportunities, honestly, are what drive you to keep going as an entrepreneur. Because to me, I look back and say, oh, man, I missed that one. But I had that opportunity, so I need to go find another opportunity and replace that opportunity. So with that, I quickly moved into nightlife here in Utah. I was involved with many of the openings of the establishments here, transferred out of that, went into direct-to-home sales, selling alarms and solar up until COVID. And then when COVID happened, I abruptly had to pivot into where I've really gained a lot of my expertise and knowledge and experience, which was I started a COVID safety supply company at the
opportunistic
peak, yeah, at the peak of COVID. I think it was about March or so of 2020. sitting in my house in Newport Beach, realizing I was kind of living outside my means and I needed to pivot quickly. And somebody that I went to church with offered the opportunity to sell like 50,000 gallons of hand sanitizer down in Mexico City, something like way outside of like anything.
Like, is this legitimate?
It did at the time. I was like, man, this is crazy. But I was unemployed essentially because of COVID. I had my back against the wall with my expenses and living in this kind of out of my means, you know, condo in Newport. Shoot, I'll sell some hand sanitizer. So that kind of got the ball rolling. And it's interesting, I was writing some notes down and I realized I went to the guy I was working for at the time and I asked him for like $5,000 to go buy masks in China. From there, we sold those and we did another order. But that was the last time him and I actually ever did business together, because I took that opportunity and never went back to selling alarms and pivoted into, you know, selling these medical supplies. To wrap this up, basically what I did was, while it was the wild, wild west, and there were a lot of people just trying to get a piece of that supply chain massacre, I should say, I kind of put my head down, realized that the only way people were going to ever buy from me is if I, you know, created a real legitimate business out of it. So what I did was I went out, I found a branding partner. She was furloughed from New Era at the time. She was the corporate New Era branding officer. And she came in and started branding me. Well, it ended up turning into going in and working out of the New Era offices because they weren't working from, you know, they were working from home. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, I'm selling COVID supplies out of the New Era office in Irvine. And stuff, it was blowing up rather quickly. And I think that has to do with me, instead of just trying to go and seize the moment, take a step back, figure out what was my pain point, solving the pain point, and then I went out and dominated. So from there, just to kind of lead to where we're at today, the company was called SOS Supply. It's still in business. We're still very successful. I made quite a bit of money through that process and didn't really have an idea of what I was going to do with it. And at the time, stocks didn't really, you know, interest me, and I wasn't really in the position to go out and buy a bunch of real estate at that time. So I really dove into blockchain and started to try to figure out how that applied to me, how it was going to apply to the future. And then to circle back, my partner now, Hubert, who actually lived in that Newport Beach home, we kind of reconvened 2 years ago and we're just checking in on each other. And I said, hey, I'm really interested in blockchain. So guess what? I'm selling Bitcoin miners and I'm consulting from a very low level standpoint, but I love it too. So from there, we jumped into what is now called Nomics. And what Nomics is we tokenize real world assets and we help implement for entities and financial institutions a roadmap for them to participate on the blockchain. And if it's just the consultation process, we love doing that. If it's the execution, I feel like that's our strong point. And layering it with our legal department that we've brought in, we've, you know, lately been seeing a lot of success and we're excited about it. So,
well, I'm excited for you guys. And I'm also interested to just get to know you better as far as the tenacity that you have, right? So you said your back was against the wall. Many entrepreneurs know what that feels like. And just to get back up and hit the ground running, make a pivot like you did, and now go all in a really emerging industry, right? Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, blockchain's emerging quite rapidly now. It's not just the present. It is the present and it's the future. So share with us a little bit about your background, what got you into technology. I know you have a kind of an analytical engineer background, correct?
Right. So I grew up in Australia, in Queensland. So my parents used to work in the aviation industry, both of them in import-export. So pre-9/11, I grew up in the cockpit, right? So I was the kid that was like, ooh, what does this button do? What does that button do?
Can I press that?
Yeah. So very, very interested in aviation technology from, I can't even remember, since I was 3 years old. Went into aerospace engineering, was in my third year of aerospace engineering at college. And at that point in time, poor, broke students, right? You're getting through your third year, you do a part-time job just to go and, you know, spend it on debaucheries and partying. You're an 18-year-old kid, right? In Australia, you just are allowed to drink at that point. At that point, one of my classmates was talking about this coin called Bitcoin, which wasn't tied to any fiat currencies. It wasn't controlled by the government. It was kind of a very, you know, idealistic vision of what monetary policy should have been. Especially, this is the point, you have to remember the mindset of the students that are actually getting into it. We are coming out of university at 20, 21 years old. We've gone through the worst financial crisis in the last 100 years. Every single person that had internships lined up, every single person that had jobs lined up, evaporated overnight. And now you had all these engineers that had 5, 6, 7 years of experience that were now applying for entry-level positions, and there was absolutely no chance for you. At this time, when Bitcoin was actually introduced to me, I kind of palmed it off for the first couple of weeks, didn't really get into it. And it was actually an article in Wired magazine circa 2011, 2012. This is 2-3 years after Bitcoin came out. We had, I think, the second biggest bullish run. I think it went all the way up to $20 or something, and then it collapsed down to $2 something. And at that point, there was an article in Wired magazine called The Rise and Fall of Bitcoin, right? How this new currency emerged and it, you know, went 100x and now it's collapsed and lost 90% of its value and it's all over. Oh no, gloom and doom. But they caveated that with, there's a booming market called Silk Road Online where, you know, people can buy different controlled items or, you know, some things that are frowned upon online in an anonymous manner. The war on drugs is one of the oldest wars that have been going on since time immemorial. And most of the time, the government policies really don't do much to quell that demand. That demand's existed since the time of human civilization. That kind of turned me onto it, which was like, hey, wait a minute. You're telling me there's an exclusive area where, you know, all these people are free to move money and they're able to transact in an anonymous manner. And it was very similar to how the adult industry kind of bought in credit cards, where back in the day, if you put credit cards online, your parents were like, oh, you're going to get hacked, right? Like, no one put your credit card online. I think that industry, and similar to, you know, the adult film industry, did the same thing for Bitcoin and blockchain, where you were able to transact on, you know, some of the niche industries which are generally frowned upon in our civilization. That kind of piqued my interest in it. I started mining Bitcoin on my university campus, got caught, had to kind of turn that off because you can't use university equipment for personal use. I ended up in aviation as soon as I graduated. Bitcoin kind of kept doing it rises and falls through, you know, 2013.
Did you continue to mine Bitcoin?
I continued to mine very small amounts of Bitcoin. I had a big batch of 1,800 Bitcoin that I ended up just giving to a friend for, you know, go and refurbish your home or something like that.
Okay.
So it was just a very generous friend when I got my first engineering job. So I just gave him my Bitcoin mining pool in a way.
How does that make you feel now?
I mean, I'm still standing in the shower some days and I do the math and I'm like, ooh, it's 42 million.
Yeah, eight.
Good friendship.
1800. Right, yeah. Right.
You also have an expensive wedding you paid for selling off.
Right, and then in 2020, just as COVID had hit, or just before COVID had hit, and we'd got Bitcoin go down to that $3,000.
Yes.
I sold another big chunk of my Bitcoin holdings to actually pay for my wedding. Right, which, I mean, it was one of the most expensive weddings that I've had once you adjust the prices.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my wife's happy at least at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I spent about seven and a half years in aviation, in commercial aviation. And my primary role, I ended up being the acting director and regional manager of engineering. And our primary objective there was creating prototypes and delivering the first 3 ship sets in any aircraft fleet. Whenever an airline would go retrofitted, acquire new aircraft, I had a team of 18 engineers, which had a further, you know, 300 mechanics under them, and we kind of worked cohesively together with the airline to get their prototypes out. Now, that industry, even though it could not be more different, but there were some very similar commonalities that I was able to, and skill sets I was able to transition across. And that was namely dealing with regulatory compliance in China, in Russia, in India, in Australia, and in America, based on the civil aviation authorities in those countries. And because we were dealing with satellite communication systems, we also had to build in, you know, identifiers. So, you know, the CIA or the KGB or whoever wanted to actually, if there were certain text messages or something that were, you know, potentially harmful to the populace or it was a national security issue, they wanted to intercept that. So in addition to that, you also need to file annual filings with the Chinese authorities and the Russian authorities. Basically, wherever the satellite is downloading to, there's a ground station for a satellite called a teleport. So whatever country is actually receiving that data set governs that FCC version of that country's authority, governs that mechanism. So having gone through the ringer and actually having to take projects from cradle to grave for airlines, where you button up those requirements in a very, very tight manner.
Detailed manner.
Yeah, and to the point where you don't get any delays, because if you get a delay, that's $90,000 an hour and the aircraft's sitting on the ground and you're just going to lose a lot of your profit margin and your penalties. Mm-hmm. So that really primed me up to start building software and hardware deliverables in a project to a level which could, you know, withstand a very high level of scrutiny from aviation authorities worldwide. One of the primary reasons why we actually ended up pivoting into Nomics, and that was kind of our secret sauce there as well, which was a lot of the cowboys and all of the developers in crypto or blockchain tech, even up till three, 4 days
ago. We don't say those words.
We don't say those words. It's the B and C word for us. You just get the use case when you're dealing with Nomics. But back in the day, a lot of these guys were just wild, wild west cowboys, right? They were self-taught. A lot of them had been, you know, anonymous users or anonymous developers. They never actually doxed themselves. And because of that, they kind of operated behind a certain wheel and they had certain flexibility. And because most of the businesses that they were creating weren't cash-flowing businesses. They didn't exist before that. So they didn't really have anything to lose. It was either a home run if we did a launch well, or, you know, we'll try again next week. Who cares? That was a fundamental difference in what we're seeing in the market today, because you're seeing traditional enterprises and traditional businesses actually start to identify the fact that, okay, blockchain technology actually does offer certain use cases that can enhance our bottom line, that can remove some of the audit and compliance burdens that we're paying, you know, the big four like EY and KPMG hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions a year to do. And your reporting is delayed and your settlements are delayed. So we started targeting those use cases. We started off in the retail sector, mostly with affiliate marketing programs and other membership-based, NFT as a membership-based kind of service, where we gave them the capability to offer discounts to their exclusive members. The exclusive members were able to use their NFTs to gain entrance to promotional events, whether they were online or offline. They were able to gain access to exclusive discounts, free products, beta tests, all those kind of things, right? Just increasing the surface area of interaction between the clients and the customers and our clients. But when we actually started pivoting at the start of this year into, once we had the tech stack built up and we're like, okay, we can keep making pretty decent money in this tokenized membership world. But where we saw the biggest bang coming over the next couple of years was actually financial institutions and niche financial institutions that were interfacing with credit unions or lending programs or things along those lines that were willing to, A, that would have the biggest benefit to their bottom line from the application of such technologies, that would have the removal of that audit trail. Yeah, sure, it's great in retail, but it's a requirement in finance,
yeah.
Right? So when we pivoted into those financiers and those bankers, we kind of were very easily able to distinguish ourselves and set ourselves apart, because we didn't just go in and say, we're going to offer you a service for $400,000 or $300,000. We came in saying, we're going to charge you X dollars. We're going to sit in with your business. We're going to figure out what your pain points today are, where you're overspending because you're using an archaic tech stack today. Like, why would you be sending faxes at 10 cents a fax when you can send an email and it's free?
Yeah.
Right?
Let's go through a scenario, actually. Let's create right now, because you guys are in the business. Let's create a problem. Mm-hmm. Let's create a problem from an industry, mm-hmm. and then how your solution is going to be solving that problem. Oh. So I'll start with you, and then I'd like to hear from you as well from more of an operational standpoint and maybe a kind of a marketing slash creative standpoint.
Of course. So let's look at the financial industry today, right? Like, let's look at even the big four banks. So what I'm actually going to talk about is actually a problem that was solved in February this year, and that kind of just opened the floodgates to what you're seeing with BlackRock ETFs and the entire institutional world actually waking up to the harsh reality that blockchain's here to stay.
Maybe give them a little context as part of the group that you're part of.
Okay, so I'm part of the digital assets cohort. It's a cohort that's put together by Jones Day. They're one of the leading law firms in the country, and they specialize specifically in digital assets and, you know, leading edge technologies. And their primary motivation in being involved in this is to write case law and to create precedents for future innovation, right? So during that, part of that cohort is US Bank, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo to a smaller extent. They're not as heavily involved. But the leaders there are JP and US Bank at the moment, right? Minus the hedge funds that are coming in today. One of the primary challenges that these big banks face on a daily basis is intraday cash flow and intraday liquidity, right? Where if you're a financial asset custodian that is, let's say, holding $10 billion in treasury bills today, right? One of the most highly liquid assets almost guaranteed by the faith of the US government, right? The problem with those assets is that in larger quantities, it's a T plus two settlement period. Right. When you trade on E-Trade, we've got tiny accounts, so they just credit us whatever we sold so we can transact again. They want to incentivize that transaction. But when you're dealing in the billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, you got to wait 2 days for your transaction to settle until you can reutilize that capital again. But that, there's two problems introduced by that. On the bank side, if you don't have enough liquidity at the end of the day, you might actually have to borrow liquidity from another bank, pay a fee for like a flash loan, and then pay it back the next day, right? One of the most impossible challenges, something that was super difficult for banks to do for that intraday liquidity at the moment, was to publish a loan in the same day and settle it in the same day to reduce your
fees.
Yeah, it was almost impossible to do in the current framework, right? Just because of how the system is architectured in the current day. What JP Morgan did is they took $70 billion of those T-bills, tokenized them, just created digital synthetic assets. They didn't tell anyone it was on the blockchain. They didn't say it was crypto-based or blockchain-based. All they did is they created digital synthetic, which had all the documentation. It adhered to all of regulatory compliance that the standard T-bill does, except this is just in a tokenized format now. It can be traded 24/7. It will have instant settlement. If you've got the money, I've got the asset.
Done.
Swaps are done instantly. What that allowed them to do is they were able to do an extra $700 billion over a period of 90 days in just sales.
With like no extra fees.
Because, well, the development fees, well, of course, right? Yeah. But at the end of the day, once you have the platform up and running, you're not handicapping your clients to sit on a chunk of their portfolio for X days. If you made profit today and if you recognize another good buying opportunity, you've got the option to go straight in. And they're just collecting their trading fees and those, you know, 0.2, 0.5% basis points. But when you're talking in the billions and billions of dollars, that adds up very, very quickly. Now, it's not that banks want to be super transparent, but banks do like an extra $14 billion in their pockets. Mm-hmm. And this is also preparing us for what we see coming up ahead with FedNow and the CBDC. So whether you like it or not, in the next 5 years, we are going to, that's the writing on the wall, right? So what our solution allows our clients to do is essentially put the rails in place. So when that solution does come on, it's just a one click and you can now accept CBDCs. Right. So it's not just solving the problem today, but also putting the infrastructure in place to build on tomorrow.
Innovation.
Yeah.
Right.
So we don't have to put all the money bags in the Wells Fargo, take it across the country. Because that was the excuse they used for a long time. And they just kept running with it. They're like, hey, you know, back in the 1800s, it took 2 days to transfer the money from one city to the next. And the banks have been getting away with that policy, using it for their own good, which is great. But, you know, now with the blockchain, you can 10x that, 20x it, 100x it.
Right, because right now they just hold on to, if I transfer money from Chase to Wells Fargo to you, settlement probably happens quicker, right? They just get to hold it on for an extra day or two. They can earn whatever basis points they're earning on that.
Yeah, so with your, so in essence, you have the speed of transfer, mm-hmm. right, number one. And then tell me more about the blockchain per se, just the blockchain as a topic in essence.
Okay.
So not just your platform. So, because I know more people out there are still curious on right. what is blockchain? How can it be incorporated into the business that I have, right. whether it be real estate, right? Because right. I think fractional ownership has been a thought, even like owning jets,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. Owning yachts, people want to do that. So yeah, share with us on how you can transact mm-hmm. and leverage blockchain.
Of course. So just a very high level overview of the blockchain. It's basically an immutable ledger, right? It's an add-only ledger where any transaction that has been logged is immutable for time immemorial. So on a very high level, it's essentially a database that you can completely trust, right? Even if I'm the administrator for database currently, if I have any SLAs or any reports that are going out to any client base, I, as the administrator, can choose to fudge it, right? Which requires all of these companies to have those audit trails in place. That's why they require to have. When I was in the airline industry, I used to spend 4 hours per airline every single month just doing reconciliation, just to make sure, hey, did we actually consume as much data as you said we consumed? Did you actually bill for the right data in the right tranches? All that goes away if it's everything's actually being logged to the blockchain, because no one is actually fudging the numbers anymore. Right, so that's the very first application. Anywhere where you want to have an audit trail or compliance baked in with 24/7 reports that are actively being pulled.
Blockchain,
right? Now, how you can apply that to various industries, we already went through tokenization of T-bills and enhancement of intraday liquidity. Tokenization of real estate is a very, very interesting concept and something that I actually developed quite a bit on one of the side projects that I was working on last year.
Naturally.
Yeah, so
we like to touch everything, yeah. You know?
So with that, one of the base argument is you create 100 pieces of a particular property, you purchase a property, you create 100 equal pieces of it, you wrap it in a Regulation A-plus wrapper, right? They can be accredited or non-accredited investors as long as there's only 100 people. That's the upper threshold,
yep.
Right? Now you can actually create a token that will have 1% claim on the cash flow from that asset, right? You'll set up a treasury account, and that treasury account gets replenished by whoever your agent is that's collecting revenue against your property. And you, as the 1% holder of that token, can claim your yield against that token.
Wow.
And you can also sell that token after a particular lockup period, like initially that has a 1-year lockup period for that sale. But after that 1 year has elapsed, you can do peer-to-peer trading off that asset as well. And Chainlink actually came up with something very interesting about 3 months ago, and then they got threatened by MLS because they were using MLS APIs without the appropriate commercial licenses, and they wanted to charge them $1 billion. But Chainlink is an Oracle service that basically takes data sets from trusted sources in the real world and appends them to the blockchain. So it's kind of a price normalizer, right? So if you have lower liquidity somewhere else, so if you have, technically that Oracle service is not, hasn't reached its potential yet, because the original use case was, we're going to take real world data and transmit it to the blockchain. Real world applications didn't even start properly until this year. So they had to find other avenues to make more money in DeFi. Which is decentralized finance, which is going to merge with finance very shortly, and I can go into that tangent in a little bit.
Well, you can just give us a prediction. What do you say is that merging point?
So if you look at companies like, or DAOs like MakerDAO, right? It's one of the biggest DAOs out there. Last time I checked, and obviously it changes every day, but they had over $600 million in assets under management.
Real quick for the audience, why don't you explain what a DAO is?
Okay. A DAO is a conglomerate of people that come together and buy ownership in a DAO, like purchase of a token. It's similar to what we were talking about, tokenized assets, a tokenized real estate,
yep,
where your tokens represent your vote in that DAO and your percentage ownership of that DAO. And it gives you some extra authority above what real estate would give you, which is the ability to govern that
company. Okay, you're saying, so a DAO, say for example, this could be a DAO.
And a DAO, right, is a decentralized autonomous organization.
Well, just, no, your podcast could be a DAO.
Got it.
Right? So yeah, if we started like five other podcast hosts that started a DAO where you contributed funds in to, yeah, buy all these camera equipment, and you have five individuals, and you can now, as your membership continues, as you become more and more popular, you can add additional members and keep growing that pool. Now,
yep,
what happens when a year down the track you have all 10 individuals have done $1 million in revenue from your podcasts? You don't really need to buy any more equipment, but you have 5 million or 4 million sitting in your account. Now, every single member that has governance or voting rights in the DAO can actually make a vote on how that asset should be used. They can create proposals. It's like a true democracy. It's like, you know, the Roman Senate back in the day. Anyone, any civilian who's part of the DAO can stand up, make a proposal, and if enough people support that proposal, the smart contract will execute it. There is no central authority. There is no CEO of a DAO. You can have council members, but at the end of the day, if enough people voted a particular way, and because everyone has the ability to create a proposal, yeah, you actually get true democracy rather than, you know, our illusion of choice, where it's like you can vote for Bill A, which kind of sucks, and vote for Bill B, which kind of sucks a little bit less than Bill A, right?
True. That's a good description.
And here in Utah, we're actually leading the conversation in legislation and lawmaking when it comes to DAOs, which is exciting. You know, a lot of people don't realize the impact that, you know, Lehi, that whole 15 corridor up to downtown is making on the U.S. The world's a bit ahead of us. Actually, we could talk about that for a little bit. We just got back from Amsterdam. We visited.
But before we just segue into that, yeah, with the MakerDAO item, the point where I was driving to was DAOs have traditionally had problems historically where most of their holdings and their assets were cryptocurrencies, which were subject to a lot of volatility, right? A lot of DAOs start lending platforms as well where their members can basically borrow funds or lend funds and earn residual income from just their holdings or the DAO's holdings. The problem that they were facing is every time during a bear market, they would get toxic debt where token value of a coin would plummet 90%. Someone had taken a 50% LTV loan out against them. They default on their loan. Now you're stuck with a toxic asset until the next bull run, and you're praying that that token isn't one of the, you know, crappy coins that's never going to rise again. Mm. To diversify themselves, they're now looking to invest at least 10% of their total assets under management into real-world assets, which are tokenized real estate, tokenized T-bills, something that is consistently injecting fiat into their ecosystem. So even in a bear market,
They still
have earn cash flow coming,
yeah,
in.
Diversification.
Right.
Hmm. That's interesting. For you investors out there, you know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So you were saying...
Back to Amsterdam. So we went to Amsterdam about a month ago for an international conference that's directed towards the fintech audience, I would say. The reason I decided that we should go out there was because here in the United States, we have a lot of yes men. Like, people are like, yeah, you're doing great. Your business is amazing. Like, obviously, we have talented people that, you know, have helped us build this. But we wanted to really find out what the rest of the world was up to. And when we went and we walked through those doors, what we realized is that the United States is so far behind. And it was awesome because we feel like we're positioned well. And, you know, the next 6 to 8 months, 15 months is really going to be awesome for a company like Nomix, because real world tokenization is going to be what NFTs were last year. What, you know, some of those gimmicky things that drove the market away, real world assets is going to bring that market back. And that's exciting for us, because we're positioned well. But what was exciting to see is that the rest of the world is already kind of down that path. And we had to kind of, you know, humble ourselves and say, yeah, we just got to be patient, or we can just move to the Middle East or Europe and we'll be, you know, stars overnight. But we really want to do it here. And we've actually positioned ourselves really well with our legal counsel, who we talked about, Jones Day. They want to see, you know, the blockchain industry really have legitimacy. And, you know, they give us a great opportunity to utilize them with our clients. And that's really kind of the direction that we want to go as a company is mm-hmm. we don't want to do anything that's going to tarnish our name, our reputation, or our clients. And what it really comes down to is really finding out at the very beginning if what we're working on is legitimate, feasible. Yeah. And then we take it to our legal team and they pass it off. Yeah, go ahead, keep going.
You know? And that's really good. And I feel like that's a great way to differentiate yourself immediately, because in a market that is like the Wild Wild West sometimes, right? You don't have that regulation that is so much needed, and you guys go in the route of, hey, listen, I've got a full legal team. You only speak to our legal team first, so then we can get a sign off, and then we can help you with our software that we now have seen work time and time again with an industry that is emerging, like you're saying. I want to shift a little bit to the peer-to-peer and how you guys have been able to continue maybe a flourishing partnership, or what has been the dynamics that you guys have had. I know there's one other co-founder, so you've got a party of three, basically.
Right. Yep.
So share with me, though, how you guys create the working dynamics that can move this company forward.
So I can start and then you can take over.
Yeah, because I'm interested.
It came with a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well,
patience is virtue.
Let's start with trials.
Right. So you've got to learn to hire fast and fire faster, right? So especially in this industry where it's emerging technology, most of the tech stack is maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, but new tools come out every single day.
Yeah.
So you need someone that's hungry. You need someone that's on the very cutting edge and who is wanting to keep them up to date, who is actually has a legit, it's a labor of love, really. You gotta love the underlying tech stack, and you gotta go gung-ho in it even if you're not making any money. And that's what I kind of was doing when I was at Panasonic Avionics. But initially, we started off in a slightly different company. So to kind of give you an overview of Nomix, we're primarily focused in blockchain's tech right now. That's our foot in the door. That's our beachhead. But there's a lot of items that we can unlock once those rails are in place. Yep. One such example of that is allowing those NFTs, that 1% token ownership that owns the apartment building or a particular apartment, allowing that 1% to have the room for 3 nights of the year. Right, so you can unlock the door to that apartment with your NFT.
Yep.
And the house, if you have digital imagery or digital screens in there, it'll be super hyper personalized for you. Pictures will change for you. Welcome, Mr. Nathan. Welcome back for the 20th time to your home away from home, whatever you want it to be. So timeshares, right, which is a very illiquid market. People get into them all the time. And even though they can get out technically,
They just
can't, because any new purchasers must go directly to the centralized entity. There is no secondary market usually for timeshares, and it's just too much of a pain to go through that secondary market, right? And that's why you have to get lawyers involved to actually get you out of those kind of dodgy contracts. But if you give a secondary market to these kinds of illiquid markets, it actually incentivizes the issuer of that timeshare to also encourage the secondary market, because they can charge a royalty every single time of the same sale.
Yeah, I see it as an additional revenue source for that. You know, and then you've got that specific segment, and then you have like 500 other segments that are very similar to tertiary markets, right? That then you can just explode.
Right, so going back into how we keep it going. So initially, Sean was obviously, he's very, very opportunistic, and he's in the right place at the right time.
Right.
Never ceases to amaze me. Sometimes where I'm just like, how the hell did you even get us in that room? But holy crap, we were in that room, right? So Sean's got a knack for that. Okay. And that's kind of what initially we started working together, just as, you know, you bring me something and I'll help you lock your customers down. It was just kind of a barter-based
system. As a visionary that I hope that I am and strive to continue to be, part of the problem is execution.
Yes.
Right? Like you can... think about all the great ideas. Like, I thought about TikTok 3 years before TikTok. I didn't have Uber. True. If I would have had Uber like 6 years ago, and I have a written out business plan for like how crowdsourcing music, which is TikTok, could have came to be. If I would have had Uber, I would have been, you know, somewhere down the line with that project. What I'm getting to is, it's one thing to have the vision or the idea. It's another thing to have a partner who sees your vision and then laughs because he's like, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. I could do it. And you're like, all right, man, let me try to give you something harder next time.
Right. And sometimes it is the, you know, the beginner's mindset sometimes where someone's like, but why isn't it possible? Right. Where sometimes you're just like, well, no, well, that's just not how we do it. And
let,
it's just
let
like,
me show you the information.
But why? And then like sometimes it's like, huh.
Now I'm actually starting to get greedy.
You're right. Why? Yeah. Well, why are we doing it in that dumb way? It's just something that the innocence of, you know, someone that hasn't been beaten up by something. So they're naive to that. And that is incredible because that unlocks a lot of vision from Sean's end where he challenges me to be like, but why?
Yeah, right? There's a really good book, actually. It's by Benjamin Hardy. It's called Who Not How.
Yeah.
Right. And then everything in life, we want to do quantum leaps.
Right.
We want to jump from, or sometimes, and sometimes very, people are very operational and that's all they see is like A to right. B to C. Well, typically entrepreneurs, in many ways, we go from like A to F. Like right. We can do this A to Z. Overnight,
right.
Right, because we see it's possible. Everything is possible. Anything is possible.
Right,
and then like you're saying, there's that naivety. But yet, sometimes when you do unlock the potential
right.
of belief, and then you guys are working together, there's something magical that can really happen through a co-founder partnership. You know, you sharpen his iron, and vice versa. Right,
yeah.
Kind of going back and forth.
Right. I also love our core value, which is. Integrity. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I think that the three of us, and I wish Sebastian was here, the three of us do so well is along the way, we've all taken it from other opportunities where we walk away and think, man, I wish my contract was a little bit stiffer, or I wish I would have talked about that with that person. Instead, I did it and now they screwed me over. And we can all, even at this table, can sit down and probably discuss multiple ways that we've been burned in the past, right? And we've all recently come out of situations where we're like, we're never going to let that happen again.
That's good.
And that's where we build our whole business foundation and why we love the blockchain and why we're so passionate about all this is because if we can just implement the blockchain, it solves a lot of these trust issues. It solves a lot of lack of transparency issues. And as a business, we can't talk one and do another. We have to, as a business as an entity, preach, you know, practice what we preach. And so that's what I love about us is when we get into our meetings and we vibe off each other, it's always based upon like, well, we want to do what's best for the customer. What does the customer need? What kind of transparency can we give them? And that's kind of where we thrive, you know?
And based on integrity, we got really lucky during the last bull run as well, where there were three or four different opportunities where we were approached by potential prospective clients.
Oh, okay.
Right? And they essentially wanted us to create a solution that didn't really get the thumbs up from either our legal counsel or, you know, we could foresee that it could be problematic. It wasn't sustainable in the long run. And we've always had this conversation where, hey, let's not screw up our $100 million trying to chase the first $1 million, right? Like you can get quick and dirty money in blockchain very, very easily.
Yeah.
But the problem is I have one guy that's, you know, scammed my wallet and cleaned it out like 5 years ago. I still track his wallet. I'm still waiting for him to do one transfer to Binance or Coinbase so I can send like people over to his home to like bank the door, right? Yeah. So it's not just an elephant's memory. It's like an immortal memory. Like it is there forever. If someone knows how to find it, and if you make one tiny little error or slip up, it's there for everyone to see. So
there's a few things that I've gotten from you guys. Number one, and you're talking about trust, integrity, right? And that's really what makes a long-term sustainable business. And you guys right. are going about it the right way. You're making sure that legal is upfront and foremost. Then you have a personal story of actually coming up against somebody that was less than integritable.
Right.
So you guys have some great ammo there to continue to build this company.
Yeah.
And flourish it with those two things.
I like the reputation in town that we're starting to gather, which is bring the projects that have legitimacy to Nomics.
Yeah.
And the ones that like used to bring us projects that aren't as legitimate, now they don't even talk to, us. They won't associate.
Don't waste your time.
Right. Yeah, because they know that we're not going to lower our standards. There's so much opportunity. I mean, there's less than 1% market penetration in our current arena. So there's no need to get desperate, you know?
Right. No, not at all. Well, that's awesome. So you guys have, so let's talk a little bit about conflict resolution. Have you guys had any, you said trials, right?
Right.
So how do you do that as founders? And then we'll just transition in and end out here, but we'll transition into where do you see the company going? What excites you with that? And then what is your timeline? So I like that. So let's do conflict resolution. Let's take a look at the company and what you're excited about and the timeline that's associated.
I got to tell this story real quick. Our first conflict was, I believe, maybe he'll say, well, our first conflict as a partnership was when I used to keep letting his dog out of our house back in the day, 7 years ago. And Uber gets so frustrated with me because I'd always leave the door open to our beach house because it's nice breeze, right? And then he'd come home and his dog would be missing. So I realized the conflict that I was addressing with Uber is he's always like a win-win type of guy. You know, even though he might be frustrated with you, he'll always try to find the positive. So knowing that, it's really easy to interact with him because you know that, yeah, he has his best interests, but he also knows that this is a relationship and he's also going to have your best interests. And so whenever we interact, I always have that basis to go off of. The second interaction of conflict was about a year ago. Things were kind of in a position where we were going to take off, but at the same time, it's much different than now where we hear a lot of yeses when we go into our client interactions. It's a lot of yeses now, whereas a year ago, it was just a lot of no's or lack of education, right? So it was really difficult for us to get the business off the ground because the adoption wasn't quite there yet. Now the adoption's like, we appreciate everybody reaching out to us and continue to, but it is nice to have that kind of demand right now. Now, a year ago, Uber and I had a little incident outside of this new job that he took because I was like gung-ho, ready to take this company to the next level. And he was in a position where he needed to have opportunity right away. And I was really disappointed at the time because I was ready to go and he wasn't because he needed some resources, right? But patience, right? Like, I don't ever think I'll gain any more valuable experience than I am right now when it comes to patience. Because things that I wanted to have happen last year are now happening perfectly this year. So I'm like, oh, Jesus.
And in part due to that role that I took as a CTO.
And that's kind of where I was getting to with that.
Right,
is that
it kind of came together just by us not losing our cool with each other.
Nope.
Yeah.
Right? And just us not just saying, you know what, screw it, I'm out.
Yeah.
Or whatever. We still kept making, you know, there's something to be said about putting something out there and then iterating on it, right?
Yeah.
So we kept iterating, taking those baby steps until a point where we were like, holy crap, it's a monster now.
Yeah.
Well, and to your guys' point, and
just
we'll
so you know, real quick, it wasn't conflict. It was actually tears. Like, I'll be the first
nothing wrong
to
with
admit,
that,
man.
You know?
I was so sad. But now, you know, look back on it, and it honestly probably was one of the best things that could have happened to us.
Right.
Yeah. No, patience is going to create a lot of, well, first off, in this circumstance, you probably had more education, more time to work on the project. So I had a call today from an entrepreneur and they said, well, man, I just don't want to lose my business.
Right.
So I said, okay, first off, let's define you losing your business.
Right.
Let's walk through the process of, see, maybe you're just needing to make a slight pivot right now. Maybe it isn't completely lost because it wasn't.
No.
Right? Because you guys are both just, hey, listen, I've got something to work towards, mm-hmm. and I've got to set my timeline of expectation. Because right. remember, expectations—they create this problem. So, right. anyway, where do you see the company going, and what excites you?
I mean,
shoot me a timeline.
Too. Okay, no, you go through the timeline. All right.
So, timeline, I'd say we're about 6 months away to 7 months away from putting out a couple of projects that we can't really discuss too freely at the okay. moment. But the moment that those projects actually launch and are in the public eye, we're not going to have any open space in our roster ever again.
Cool.
And that's not just us. It's we've heard from everyone, from our legal counsel, from people in that digital assets cohort, and even to a point, Sean, somehow, like I mentioned, got me in a room with a Rothschild equity oh, yeah. partner.
I didn't want to bring that up, but that was a good win for me.
And I was like, ooh, that's...
I'd do a high five.
Yeah, dude, it right. was awesome.
So,
and she gave us a clear-cut outline.
Yeah. So we told her what we'd bootstrapped to. We're like, look, we're about at $1.5 million over the last year, and we kind of did it part-time.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to get more serious. We have the resources. We're scaling teams up. We're getting more clients in. The market's heating up. And we were given a target of about $7 million
okay.
the day we hit $7 million because they don't write checks small enough.
No.
Right? So you got to have at least a certain valuation where they're writing a big enough check for you.
Okay.
And at that point, the way that we've been building our platform and building our tech stack as well is it's a modular solution.
Yes.
Right? So as we...
Like water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we're basically targeting various industries, we've already productized the affiliate marketing in the membership industry.
Okay.
Next, we're going to be looking at productizing the any kind of debt, any kind of loan, any kind of lending and borrowing that's happening in traditional institutions without even the customer even knowing they're using blockchain stack in the back end. They can still transact in fiat. Everything looks exactly the way it does today. You can still log in with Google just using a different platform.
That product's probably 4 months away,
okay,
which is going to be huge. Like that one right there. Game changer. I think for us, like if anybody's listening, the wheels are starting to turn. Like obviously we see a huge value to what we bring and we see that the horizon looks bright. But where people could really help us out, and if you're listening right now and you're thinking, oh man,
how do I
get involved? Or better yet, like how can this better myself or my business? Hit us up, like email us, go onto our website, but we're not really looking for capital investment right now. Like that'd be nice. Like that'd be really great to help us scale quicker. But where we have found us really benefiting from participation is awesome use cases.
Okay.
So like if you have something out there and you're like, man, I really, really would love to tokenize that. Or, you know, I've really been waiting for a Sean or Newbear or a Nomix to come into my life, like that's what we want to hear. We want to hear from people that are like, hey, let me hear a little bit more about what you guys can do for me.
Right.
That helps us out the most.
And some of the most lowest hanging fruit that we've found success with a lot of the smaller customers that are not enterprises, we're literally just streamlining their back office operations and allowing them to not have any chargebacks below $1,500. So it was putting the control back in the hands of the vendor where they get to go through your complaint resolution process rather than just calling up Amex and saying, okay, have a good day, see you later. I have your product and now I have your money, right? Mm-hmm. So that was just that revenue leakage, stopping that revenue leakage. You can hire an entire support staff with the revenue leakage you have on just credit card fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So if you need just one other person to respond to tickets and events and you grant maybe a tenth of the refunds you were before and you're getting instant settlement into your bank accounts, and right now, the yield is a little bit lower in DeFi, but we're going into the bull run again. We're going to be getting 10 to 12% yields on stable coins in the next bull run. Again, happens every time. If you just got $50,000, $100,000 sitting there, why not put it under like 12% APY compounded daily?
Well, the future is bright for blockchain. The future is bright for Nomix. And
thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us, Nathan. Appreciate you.
Yeah, podcasts are always good. And, you know, we just get to see the innovation that's coming out from entrepreneurs just like yourself. And if you guys are out there and you're listening to this podcast, you want to follow it, you want to subscribe, feel free to do so. And if this was really helpful for you and your inspiration, as well as the education that you needed in regards to the blockchain, feel free to share this with other people. Once again, my name is Nathan Bird with the Founders Odyssey, and thank you so much for joining us.